What's up, everybody? I'm Nick Botic. I just wanted to let you know ahead of time that for the first 2 to 3 minutes of the episode, there is a clicking going on. It doesn't really interfere with the conversation we're having, but just so you know, it does not last the entire episode. I don't even think it lasts full 3 minutes. Just wanted to give you a heads up. Enjoy the episode. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to This Weird House. I am your host, Nick Botic, and today I have with me a very special guest, a gentleman I have spoken to before and have been looking forward to speaking with again. He is the author of several novels and short story collections. He is Mr. Brian Evenson. How are you today, Brian?
Good, thanks. How are you doing?
Not bad, not bad. Thank you again for taking the time to speak with me. I'm not just being polite and saying that I really have been looking forward to talking to you.
No, that's good. Yeah.
So I usually start with like a baseline question for the authors that I interview. What got you interested in horror? Like, what was your horror journey like?
I mean, mine was a little different, I think, from a lot of people in that I didn't really grow up reading horror, but I was writing work that I thought of as like literary innovative fiction that had kind of a weirdness to it and had kind of horror components, but I just didn't, I think, realize it at the time. And then it wasn't until like maybe 2003, I had a book come out called The Wavering Knife. And I heard it was a finalist for the International Horror Guild Award. And I thought, that's weird. I don't know quite how that's happened. And then it won that award. And then that confused me and also made me, you know, think I maybe needed to look into the genre. And so I ended up reading all the, you know, the work that was up in my category. It was a short story collection. And that made me realize that, you know, my sense of what horror was not really the same as what was going on in the genre right now. And so suddenly I realized, oh, yeah, you know, I have a lot of connections to these writers. There's a lot of interesting things going on in horror. And I think that's just become more and more the case. I think it's really become a genre that's just super interesting and intriguing. So, yeah. So I kind of came into it from the outside. I know a lot of people, like, you know, they read the big horror books in the 70s and that's how they got into it. And for me, it was just like I stumbled my way in and then it just seemed like a really comfortable home once I was finally there.
For sure. That makes sense. So once you did start reading, more horror, what mm-hmm. authors did you kind of flock to in a way? Like who caught you the most?
Yeah. You know, Peter Straub was huge for me in terms of that. He was the one who was, as much as anyone, kind of led me into the genre. Yeah, he was huge. But I also, you know, I felt like I had to do a lot of catch up. So I read, you know, some Stephen King and read some, a lot of Lovecraft and just, you know, kind of tried to expose myself to people. And then, you know, really contemporary people I loved, you know, once I started reading them, Laird Barron and John Langan, Paul Tremblay, people like that. And then, yeah, just that kind of opened the door to all sorts of other people.
That makes sense. I did have a question about a particular story of yours from Windeye, I believe, was your first short story collection, mm-hmm. I believe.
It was an early one, but it wasn't my first one, yeah.
Oh, gotcha. Sorry. Yeah. Okay. But yes, a very, very, very short story from Windeye, A History of the Human Voice. Mm. And I'm just kind of curious where that one came from. It's such an odd little thing. I don't really like, it's definitely weird, capital yeah. W weird. I don't yeah. know if it's exactly horror, but yeah, it's yeah. just, it's, I've read it like 10 times and I'm curious where that came from.
You know, it came from, I actually was, I just stumbled across this piece of research that that there was someone who very early on had used smoke and paper to kind of record the patterns of the voice in terms of vibration. And there wasn't a sense that it would necessarily ever be something that could be played, but it was, you know, that was something that was you know, just historically there. And then maybe 5 years ago, someone figured out how to play those patterns of smoke on paper, and so you could suddenly awesome. Hear these voices from like pre-phonograph days. And they were, you know, they're very distorted. It's like it's not the clearest thing in the world, but that was kind of the start of it for me. And then also the sound of it did sound, because of the distortion, it sounded like bees almost. And so those things kind of came together for me for that story. And it's just, yeah. So often with stories for me, it's just like weird details kind of capture my attention. And then that leads to, you know, something.
For sure. Yeah. I can see, I didn't even know that it was based in fact at all. So that's really interesting. Mm. I did also want to talk to you about, so you've written the novelizations of a couple different, I guess, previously established properties. The Dead Space series you've written a couple novels in, I believe, right?
Yeah, you're right.
Okay, credit is B.K. Evenson. I hope I'm not talking to a totally different person.
No, that's the same guy, yeah.
Okay, cool. the one I really wanted to talk to you about, though, is the Lords of Salem novelization. Mm-hmm. That is my favorite Rob Zombie movie. Well, that's a lie. I just lied to you, Brian. My favorite Rob Zombie movie is House of 1,000 Corpses, but The Lords of Salem is just behind it, and I think it is his most undervalued work.
Yeah.
I just kind of wanted to know how did you come to be the one writing that novelization, and I guess just the process of doing so. Like, how did you pick what, I mean, obviously you're writing it from a pre-established work, the film, but how did you decide what to expand on, what to leave out, what to add in, and so on?
Well, so that kind of started because there was a writer named David Peek who was working for an agent who was the agent who was kind of selling this project. And David said, really interesting kind of horror writer, David. But he suggested me, he was like, you know, Brian, I'd be a really good fit for this project. And so they approached me and, you know, said, do you want to do this novelization of this movie that's coming out? The movie wasn't out at this point. And I said, sure, I'd be interested. I like his work. I like his music. I've seen him play before. And so that kind of started. So the first thing they did is they just sent me a kind of treatment of it. So it was like a 3-page thing that kind of went through the whole, you know, in not very much detail, the plot of the piece itself. And I thought, and initially I thought, okay, I'll work on this. I'll use this and develop a novel. But as time went on, I thought, you know, I should just look at the script. And so they arranged for Rob to send me the script. I picked that up and then just developed a kind of book based on that. The funny thing is that I didn't actually invent all that much with it. I mean, I did kind of expand a few things, but the original script had most of those details in them. And then what happened, I think, is when they did the rough cut of the script after he shot it, it was way too long. And so he ended up kind of trimming things back and cutting things. And that ended up making the movie as we have it, which I really like the movie a lot. I feel like it's like strange. It feels very, you know, Argento-like or something in some ways. It's just, it's more abstract than other things.
It's very surreal.
Yeah, yeah. So, but really most of the details that you find in the novel are things that were originally in the script and that just got cut out in the process. And then a few of those are, you know, kind of like there was a small hint of something and I took it and expanded it and moved it in a different direction. Okay. So, yeah.
That's awesome. And then, for the video game adaptations you've done, or I guess not really adaptations, but because I believe you wrote prequel novels for the Dead Space series.
Yeah.
Were those just offers that came across your desk, or were you fans of the, or were you a fan of the series beforehand? And then they offered it and you were like, yes, please.
Yeah. Yeah. I was a fan of the series. That kind of started because I did this, Aliens, novel it's actually, I was at a book festival and Victoria Blake was working for, Dark Horse Comics at the time. And she read some of my work and really wanted to kind of publish it at Dark Horse, kind of do a novel line there. And it didn't work out, but she wrote back and was like, we're not gonna be able to do your book, but would you like to do either an Aliens novel or a Predator novel? And I said, yes, I'd love to. And I'd like to do Aliens, because, you know, that's the one I grew up with. It's the one that I felt most connected to. And then kind of made arrangements, suggested Jeff Vandermeer for the Predator novel, which he ended up doing. So that was the start of like me doing adaptations. And then what happened was there was an editor at Tor who saw that adaptation and realized, oh, Brian Evanson will do these things. And this guy named Eric Robb, he's no longer there. He's kind of gone into the video game world. But he was like, you know, would you like to do a video game? And the choices at the time, I think, were BioShock and Dead Space. And both, you know, I'd played both games. I liked both games. But Dead Space was the one that felt like it kind of fit my personality more. And so I decided, yeah, I was willing to do it. And they said, all right, go ahead and write up a 10-page outline of what you do. So I did that. And then the process of doing that, I was like, you know, I'd really like to kind of shift the lore of the game a little bit. And I'm like, they'll never let me do it, I felt. But I was just like, I'm just going to put it in the proposal and see what they do. And so gave them the proposal. They were like, yeah, great, let's do it. And they were willing to kind of make the suggestion that like everything that people thought they knew about Michael Altman, who's the kind of character that's behind a lot of the books, he's kind of in the, you never meet him because he's been long dead, I think, by the time things start. But he's seen as the founder of this religion, Unitology, that's part of the book. They were willing to let me say, you know, what people thought they knew about him was wrong. And so that was really fun for me, just because I love the game. I love the feel of the game, but I also was like, all right, I get to kind of take this idea and just move it in a direction that I really love.
That's awesome. And like, it's so cool knowing that you've like contributed to this, like this mythology that you were already previously a fan of. That's like a dream of mine. That's so cool.
No, it's fun.
It actually leads into a question I usually don't get to ask until later in the interview, but for you, it's particularly relevant, considering you have done work in Aliens and Rob Zombie's world in Deep Space. Is there any character or world that you, any sandbox you, if you could jump into any sandbox and write for any character or video game, movie world, TV world, horror world, which would you do?
I mean, there's lots that would be fun to work in, and that's, you know, it would be a blast to do. I always love doing that. I love kind of working in these worlds that are created, because it's like you have the parameters are set up, but then you can also find your own space in them. So I think the one that I'd be most interested in doing probably is The Last of Us. It'd be really fun to do a video game, a novel in that space. Because I love those games. I think they did a really good job with the TV adaptation as well. But I feel like that there's things you could do with that with a novel that, you know, are distinct and interesting. So probably that one. But I mean, there's all sorts of just, you know, there's so many good games and so many interesting things out there.
For sure. Are you a big gamer, I'm guessing?
I am. I'm not very good at it. So I always play on like the easiest settings, but I really do enjoy playing.
Me too.
Yeah.
Are you playing anything right now?
I'm always, the thing I've been playing lately is the new Diablo. That's fun for me. That's like a game that I kind of, you know, played all the way along in terms of the earlier versions. Mm-hmm. And I'm doing that. And then I've been playing Hades as well, which is a lot of fun.
Not familiar with that one.
Yeah, it's very simple. It's just you're a character who is in hell, and you keep on dying and coming back to life. But it's interesting. It's very simple, but also like really effective.
That is cool.
Yeah.
And kind of to circle back around, you mentioned that, you know, Michael Altman from Dead Space is the founder of the religion Unitology.
Yeah.
And kind of piggybacking off of that, religion is a pretty common theme in in a lot of your work. Just kind of where does all that come from?
Well, so I am, a lot of people know this about me, I'm an excommunicated Mormon. I left on my own, but I was kind of pressured out because of my fiction. So I think kind of growing up in that culture, I also grew up in it in a weird way because my parents were both Democrats. My dad was the head of the Democratic Party there. So I was kind of, very few Mormons are Democrats. So I was kind of always in this weird space in relation to that culture. And I think that thing of kind of being on the edge of a culture lets you kind of critique it in a different way, or lets you see aspects of it that if you're like deeply embedded in it, you just are, you know, sometimes invested in not seeing what's actually going on. So I think that I grew up very skeptical. I grew up kind of thinking about religion and the way in which religion kind of directs or controls people for better or for worse. And that's something that, you know, it's almost something I do without thinking about it necessarily. It's just something that comes up as I write, because I think so much about the relationship of the individual to authority and society, but also kind of, control is a big thing.
For sure. And then that leads into one of my favorite novels of all time, hands down, Last Days. Mm. And I've lost track of how many times I've left comments on posts on Reddit, Facebook, Twitter, whatever, of people asking what they should read. My go-to answer is Last Days. Mm. And I just, so I guess I know where the, I now know where the idea or the just theme of religion comes from, but yeah. Where did the idea for the cult of Last Day, the cult detailed in Last Days come from? Where did that idea come from? Just, I want to know everything about Last Days.
Okay. Absolutely. so that started because Paul Miller at Earthling Press wrote to me and he wanted to do a chapbook. And I had wanted to do a kind of noir, and his press is all kind of horror stuff. So I started thinking kind of along those lines. And then, you know, it really began from, there's a, this moment in the book of Matthew where it says, if thy right hand offend thee, then cut it off. And, you know, this Bible verse. And I just started thinking, what if someone just took that totally literally, and just, you know, kind of move forward with this idea that the way you become closer to God is that you end up with less and less of yourself in the world. And so it started with that. And then I saw this documentary. I don't remember if I saw the documentary, but I heard about, people who believed in elective amputation, that's like, they felt like they had too many limbs. And so they deliberately would do things to kind of lose a limb as a way of kind of feeling more like themselves. So kind of interesting body dysmorphia. And there was a documentary about it, but I don't think I'd seen the documentary at the time. And so those two things kind of came together for me in terms of thinking about it. I just kind of ran with it. And just tried to take it really seriously in terms of like the people who are doing it kind of believe in what they're doing. And, you know, this is the weird thing about religion is it looks normal from the inside often, even if it looks totally crazy from the outside. And so my idea with this was just like, all right, you have someone who has entered into this situation and is like, doesn't know what to do, or doesn't, you know, obviously is not a believer, but is also kind of trapped into this. And how does he deal with this or cope with this? How does he escape? So, and then I've written, I don't know if you know this or not, but I just finished a sequel to Last Days called Phantom Limb.
You did mention that. I cannot wait.
It'll be a while before it's out. It'll be at least a year, maybe a little longer. And that kind of picks up on his story, and you know, he loses more of himself, so to speak. So
I love the double meaning there. Yeah. I jump around a lot on this.
Yeah, sorry, yeah, jump around is good.
Ping pong.
So, yeah.
Are you a big horror movie guy? That might sound like a real easy question, but surprisingly, a lot of horror writers are not.
Mm-hmm. I do watch a lot of horror movies. So, yeah, I mean, it varies. There's some I really like and some I don't like as much. But, yeah, I do try to keep up with horror movies. So,
what kind of horror movies kind of get you the most? Is there a particular subgenre that gets under your skin more, or is there a different one that you just happen to enjoy overall more? Mm-hmm. What kind of horror movies does Brian Evenson like?
J horror, I really love Japanese horror. And I think the reason I love it so much is because, I feel like, and you know, Asian horror in general, I think, but there's something about Japanese horror where you get the sense that people are really, they kind of believe what's going on, as opposed to, I think a lot of American horror is about like the people who don't believe and then they have to be convinced and then they're killed. But you can think about it. I think it's like The Grudge, the Japanese version. It's like the someone explains to the detective that's in that there's a ghost and this is what's going on. And he just says, "I see." And then just kind of goes on with it. And the Japanese, the American version, it's just like, it does this thing where it's like, there's a police officer and they tell him about this stuff. And he's like, "No, there's ghosts aren't real," and doesn't believe in it. And there's something to me just way more frightening about the whole culture of people, at least in the movies, that believe in this stuff, you know? So there's something that just makes it more alarming in that way. So, yeah.
For sure. Like that's one of my least favorite tropes, and it's in so many American horror movies where I notice it a lot with kids when there's like a kid is being kind of terrorized by some kind of entity or monster or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I always think to myself when I'm sitting there watching these movies and this kid is telling their parents like, "Yeah, there's a monster in my closet," or whatever. And they're like, "Oh no, of course there's not." But then it happens over and over and over. The parents still isn't believing them. And it's like, okay, even if there's not an actual monster in the closet, something is terrifying your child, and like something is still wrong. Like,
absolutely.
Stop completely. It drives me crazy. I don't even have kids yet, but like, I don't know. That's just bad parenting.
It's definitely weird parenting or bad parenting for sure. So yeah, I teach a class called The Monstrous and the Terrible and talk about fiction and film in that class. And that's really fun for me, both to introduce the students to like, we start with the fiction, we start early and kind of move forward from Poe and then kind of go to more contemporary stuff at the end. But then also the movies, it's like, I always teach like The Thing for that class. I love that movie. And
classic.
And sometimes teach The Shining. I have various other things I teach depending on, you know, what the iteration of the class is.
For sure. I was just talking to my dad like 20 minutes before we started doing this interview about The Shining. Have you ever seen the 1997 miniseries of The Shining?
I saw it when it was on, but it's been a long time since I've seen it.
Yeah.
I remember not liking it as much, but I haven't given it a chance since then.
In my opinion, it is Kubrick's version is clearly more technically proficient. It's an astonishingly well-made film. Mm-hmm. The 97 version to me is just so much scarier. And
And
as far as like following the book, it is much more faithful to the book.
Yeah. I knew that about it, that it was more faithful to the book. I should revisit it because it's been like more than 20 years since I've seen it, almost 30 now. So
yeah, it's worth checking out again, I would say. My recommendation means nothing to you, but if you take one from me, I would say revisit it. I just put a lot of pressure on myself for you to like this.
All right, I'll check it out.
I will have sullied my reputation.
No, don't worry.
I was going to ask, so you teach a class on kind of horror over this.
Yeah.
From Poe on. And you're actually a very interesting person to ask for this, considering you do teach a class like that. What are like the major ways that horror literature has changed from those early days of Poe and, you know, Lovecraft and that to today?
Well, I think it's changed in a lot of ways. I mean, it's part of the thing is there's things that have always been there, but like the work that people have focused on has maybe changed in some ways. I think that in terms of contemporary horror, there's things have changed a lot just in terms of who's writing it. You know, that you have a lot of people who are from underrepresented groups who are very involved in horror at this point. You have a lot of people who are not male who are doing it as well. And that was, you know, for a number of years with the genre, that was really the focus. There were female writers who were writing horror kind of even early on, but they didn't always get the attention that they deserved mm-hmm. necessarily. So that's something that is big that's changed. I think the other thing that's changed is the way that we just think about horror. I mean, we have these notions now of things like slow horror, where, you know, it may be that it's not even all that scary, but it kind of creates a sort of mood or something. And you know, that kind of diversification of genre, where you kind of move into different kind of subcategories of horror. And one thing that's always interesting when I talk to people about horror, it's like, you have the people, like when I teach that horror class, you have the people who are like horror film junkies, who will watch anything, including movies that like I have no interest in. And then you have people who are like, oh, I really like horror, but I only like psychological horror, or I only like, you know, suspense-based horror. I don't like supernatural horror. Or you have the people who are like, I really like supernatural horror, but I don't like this other stuff. And then you have the people who are like, I really like splattery stuff, and, you know, so on and so forth. So it's like, it's funny just the degree to which it's become, the subgenres have become so defined in terms of horror, and in terms of how people, you know, think about it. You know, to be honest, it's like some of the horror that I like the very best is kind of science fiction horror, SF horror. So Alien, I think of in those terms. I think of, you know, like The Thing that we were talking about earlier. But there's, you know, there's all sorts of things kind of in that space that really work for me. And one of the great things about kind of contemporary horror is that, you know, it's really as much as anything about a mood. So you can have horror in almost any other sort of genre as well. So it's a very dynamic genre as a result of that. So, which is, you know, it's, I think that's also why I'm drawn to it, is it's like, I can put together a book of stories that kind of have things that look more like science fiction, things that look like more literary, things that look more like traditional horror, and they can all be kind of talking to one another, and people are willing to at least buy that it's horror in some way.
For sure. I've seen your work described as minimalist. Yeah. Literature, or minimalist fiction, or just the style of writing as being minimalist. And I've been reading your work for several years now, and once I saw it described as that way, I was like, that makes a lot of sense. How do you go, or I guess, how do you reconcile writing with such a minimalist style versus creating a fully fleshed out mm-hmm. just whole story, if that makes
yeah.
sense?
Yeah, yeah. Well, so one thing I do when I write is I really see the reader as part of the process, and the reader is there to kind of help fill out and complete the story. So I feel like the reason people call my work minimalist is that I'm really giving people moments that serve as catalysts for them to understand the story and kind of take it in, because I want them to feel it more than just like see it at a distance from themselves. And so very often, I mean, I think the challenge as I'm writing is I want to give people just enough that their imagination really starts working, but not too much where they feel like I'm imagining things for them. So it's a balancing act. It's like, I want to give you enough to kind of create a certain mood. I want to kind of push you in a certain direction. I want to make some things very, very precise, so you have a sense of, you know, a place or something. But there's all sorts of other things that I don't care that much about, that I can kind of leave vague. And in that sense, it's, you know, you know, there's very little backstory in a lot of my fiction. There's certain details are very, very clear. Other details are just left completely up in the air. And yeah, it's kind of balancing it. So, and of course, you know, any work of fiction is leaving some things vague. But it's like, you know, it's some things are very thick in terms of the kinds of details they give you, and other things are very thin. So it's more like provoking your own imagination, I feel like, with my work. So, and there's lots of stories that I write that you know, they're quite short, and that I could probably take them and make them into a longer story. But it's also like I just, you know, if I'm not necessarily interested in doing that, because I feel like they do a great deal when they're short in a way that is more interesting to me than if they were 30 pages rather than 7 pages, and just explain right. things a lot more. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's a fairly commonly held, you know, idea that like horror works best in the short form. Mm-hmm. It's a lot easier. Yeah, like you said, it's a lot easier to pack a punch in 7 pages than it is in 30. Or, yeah. you know, creating, crafting, and maintaining suspense or atmosphere is always going to be more effective the shorter a person is invested in that story, so to speak.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. You're the reason that some of my stories actually, I don't name the protagonist or like the narrator. You're like, I'm sure I'd read stories before yours that where the narrator wasn't named, but you were the first one I consciously picked up on it and was like, oh yeah, I guess I don't have to explain this person's whole backstory and why they're telling this story.
No,
that was a game changer for me. So thank you for that.
Oh, you're welcome. You're welcome. Yeah. I mean, sometimes there's reasons to do it, but it's like, you know, you don't always have to. So
yeah. I mean, they say that no monster is going to be scarier than the one that you're picturing yourself. So I've definitely always held true to that.
Right. And you can see that in so many movies that you're like, it's thrilling when you're seeing like little bits of the monster, or you have the implication of the monster, and then you see the whole monster and you're like, oh, okay.
Oh, that's it. So,
Every once in a while, someone does an amazing job with it, but it's
For horror working better in shorter form, I think is especially true of like cosmic horror, and Lovecraftian sorts of stories like that. Because I mean, I'm on a Lovecraftian kick. I've been on a Lovecraftian kick for the last like decade, so I don't think it really counts as a kick anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
but there's really are very few novels that are truly Lovecraftian start to finish. Like some will have elements of it, you know, here and there, and like the book's many years old, but Revival by Stephen King is always classified as, I'm not sure if you've read that one, it's classified as a Lovecraftian story, and it is, because the overall story itself is, but really the Lovecraftian elements don't come in until the last like 10 pages almost. But this thing's kind of sprinkled throughout, so I think it's one of the ones where that adage of it being of horror being more effective in the short form is definitely most true in that.
I think his Lovecraft's cosmic horror, some of which I like very much, like The Whisperer in the Darkness is a story I really love. But he makes use of the short form in a way that's effective. And even though you know, At the Mountains of Madness really works for me, even though it's a little bit longer, but there's, I think it's significant that he didn't write much that was longer than that. So.
Yeah. And I think, At the Mountains of Madness works also because really nothing like that had ever been done before. And I think even if you're not reading it with that in the forefront of your mind, I think any reader who is just getting into Lovecraft will know, oh, this story is going on 100 years old now. This not something that was common back then. So like, that might maybe subconsciously influence someone. I know, excuse me, I know that kind of thing goes through my head every once in a while when I'm reading older works like that.
Oh yeah, for sure. And I mean, it's interesting to me, the older works that feel like they hold up and the ones that don't so much. And sometimes it's the work that, you know, that didn't get the attention it should have in its time, but was looking forward in a way that was really interesting. So one of the writers who I really love the most is Robert Aichman. And I find his work kind of endlessly fascinating. And, you know, he's kind of horror adjacent in some ways. He's not exactly horror, or sometimes he is, but not always. But it's those stories just feel very fresh to me, even though they were written, you know, many, many years ago now. So.
Yeah. I'm just now starting to get into Aichman. I read his, The Hospice. Is
that Hospice.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. It's where car breaks down. He's walking down the side of the road. I read it about like a year ago. I say I'm getting into him now. I'm a slow reader. What was I going to ask? So if we can actually stay on Lovecraft for a minute, what has made his work so, what has made it endure for so long? Like what is it about the fear of the unknown and how he wielded it that has made his work, which was not all that popular when mm-hmm. he was alive back in the 20s and 30s. And, mm-hmm. but what has made it kind of go on a steady increase in popularity over the, you know, last 80, 90, 100 years.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I think that's a good question. I think part of it is that, so you have someone like Poe who has his own particular take on horror and terror. And, you know, it's very much about, you know, humans and what humans are doing to one another. And then what Lovecraft does is he comes along and really is kind of creating this whole mythos in which the idea, I think, is that humans are just insignificant. You know, these creatures that are from you know, elsewhere, if they notice us at all, it's like they don't consider it. So it's just like it's this kind of movement towards almost this existential consideration of what humans are, that we don't matter necessarily, that you know, there's this kind of this the vastness of something that's just terrifying. And I think it's a counter to the idea of like what you get with people like Elon Musk, where it's like we can expand into the stars and we can, you know, settle Mars and things like that. And Lovecraft is like, oh no, it's a terrible, awful void out there. And anytime you get in proximity to it, it's going to destroy you. So I feel like that there's some appeal in that in terms of just as a kind of counter to other notions. So, and you know, and Lovecraft is tricky because he feels dated in many ways. But at the same time, I mean, there is something about the kind of intensity of his work that I find really, really interesting. He's someone I came to pretty late. I probably came to him in my maybe 20s, I guess, late 20s. But he did feel to me like, you know, someone who I was surprised I hadn't come across a little bit earlier.
I was the same way. I had been pretty strictly, you know, the Stephen King, pretty strictly Stephen King, actually. He was my main baseline for horror. And I'd Clive Barker, I got into quite a bit. But once I did find Lovecraft, which was only maybe in the last, probably about 10 years or so, it gripped me, and I have really never been able to articulate why. Mm-hmm, it's mm-hmm. just it. I if I have a fear, it is that kind of existential fear. I mean, that and spiders, but mm-hmm, I don't really count mm-hmm. that. But yeah. I do have that existential. Just I'm in a constant state of existential anxiety, Brian. Yeah, it's terrible. Yeah. It's terrible. Yeah, what's going on up here?
Right. I mean, he really did foresee that in a way that was interesting, I think. And so that may be one of the reasons that he's ended up being so important. So, and you know, I've thought a little bit about, you know, what is it that suddenly he's been ratified? Cause it's like, you have the Library of America that did those volumes of his work, for instance. And so suddenly it's like, he's in the canon next to Mark Twain and, you know, other people. And part of that is just the Library of America was opening up to different sorts of things. They're doing noir stuff now and science fiction as well. But on the other hand, I mean, there is something about his work that feels very particularly American, both in its kind of good points and its bad points. And in that sense, it's like he has come to, you know, represent a moment in the culture, but also kind of because you can see the way in which stuff that came after him seems to be on a similar thread, even though they're not necessarily following in his footsteps so much as just like he tapped into something that people tapped into like more intensely later, both philosophically and in terms of literature. I think that's maybe why he's become important.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's a lot of people who, I should say, there was a time where it seemed a lot of authors were kind of not grasping what Lovecraft's work was all about, because to the general public, you know, the general to most people who have heard of Lovecraft, they immediately think giant tentacled squid monsters from space. But yeah, like it's crazy how really deep his stuff goes into kind of examining the just fear in general, really, not even any kind of particular fear, but he just kind of dissects the idea of being afraid and not knowing why, almost kind of. And yeah, that's what grips me so much with his stuff, because I'm afraid all the time and I have no idea why. What scares you for when you're, if you're reading a book, what to you makes a good, scary, compelling horror novel or short story, whatever it may be?
Well, so I do think that the unknown is way more terrifying than like something that you can kind of pin down. And so I think for me, it's a lot that sometimes, you know, something that'll really scare me, it is almost like that I'm not quite, taking it in some ways. It's like, it's something that I can't quite get my mind around. Trying to think of what I've read, you know, one of the few writers who kind of consistently scares me, at least with his horror fiction, is Laird Barron. And I think it's partly just the style of how he writes, that there's moments where he can be a little evasive, but it's also like he's willing to go places that not everybody's willing to go. Yeah, I'm trying to think of what else. There's a moment, I guess the book that most recently scared me as I read Our Share of Night by Maria Enriquez, which is like, it's a huge long novel. It's like 600 pages, but it's about kind of like possession and you know, manipulating spirits and all of this stuff. And there's a moment in which someone goes into a house and the house is just wrong inside. And that really terrifies me, these spaces that seem to not be conforming to the laws that we know and things like that. So, yes. so that was a book that kind of gave me nightmares. And not all of it. There's a few moments that I just was like blown away by. And I think that's the issue with horror novels versus horror short stories, is it's like you have these moments in the novels, but there's lots of like valleys before you get to those peaks. And then a short story, it can be all peak if you want, you know, you can have a kind of intensity that's just really focus of the story.
I actually got into a bad habit for a little while where I was writing just scenes more than stories, and like it became kind of a detriment, because I was like, this isn't what I want to be doing, but it's just how my it's what's coming out when I'm typing. And it actually helped then transitioning to writing my first novel, Self-Promotion, which came out last year. It kind of helped break me of that a little bit, but what did you say that book was called? I just want to write that down.
Oh, it's Our Share of Night by Mariana Enriquez. It's she's a Latin American writer. She's really good. She also writes short stories. She has several collections of short stories, which are
okay. I'm not familiar with her. I'll have to check her out.
I'd say right, start with the stories and then go to the novel. Yeah.
Okay, definitely. Yeah, I will absolutely do that. I just finished a book 2 days ago, and I'm looking for something new to read, so I think I'll start with that.
Can I ask what you finished 2 days ago?
Yeah, it was I can't say too much about it, actually. It was an advanced copy for a friend of mine. His name is Felix Blackwell, and he wrote a book called Stolen Tongues, and this is the prequel to Stolen Tongues. There was the original story that Stolen Tongues was based on is one of the all-time classics of No Sleep, which is a Reddit community where he, myself, and a handful of other people who are now more in getting into the mainstream, or not mainstream, the traditional writing path, so to speak, it's where we all got our start.
Right.
So yeah, it was really cool.
Yeah, yeah, and then, that's great.
I'm currently, or I have, so since I finished that a couple of days ago, it always takes me forever to find something new to read. Like, mm-hmm. I always start 10 things before one finally sticks. And yeah. I think I might have found something that I'm less ambivalent about. And mm-hmm. it's, mm-hmm. have you ever heard of a guy named, blanking, David Conyers?
Maybe. What's it? Uh-huh.
It's, I think the book is called, or he wrote a character called Harrison Peel, Major uh-huh. Harrison Peel. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I think the books that I got this like package of three books. It's like Cthulhu Reloaded, Cthulhu something. I don't remember. It's, but yeah, it's a collection of a bunch of short stories featuring this Harrison Peel character.
Mm. Interesting.
Cause yeah, the novel that I'm working on right now is my first foray into, I'm trying to do a full length Lovecraftian novel in the way that I was talking about before, where it is the entire novel rather than just these.
Cool. Yeah,
it's actually something else I wanted to talk to you about, but I'll do that off of this. Sorry. What was I gonna say? Oh, if somebody wanted to find, or if somebody wanted to get into Brian Evenson's work, where would you direct them? Like, what story would you tell them to start with?
Well, so with novel, I think Last Days is a good one to start with, which is kind of crazy and intense and funny and bizarre. That's the one that, like, most people, that's the book of mine that more people end up doing. In terms of stories, I mean, I would say a good place to start is, there's a little story I wrote called No Matter Which Way We Turned, which is like 2 pages long. And that'll kind of tell you, it gives you a kind of exposure to what I do and how I do it, and can do it very quickly. Either that, or there's a story called Wind Eye from the collection of the same name. That also, I think, does fairly directly and elegantly kind of what I do in other stories as well.
I love Wind Eye. Mm. I love that story.
Thank you. I'm glad.
I love the whole collection. All right. If people want to find you online, where should they go?
They can go to www.brianevenson.com. I'm on Facebook as well, if people want to do that. I've avoided other forms of social media, even though I know Facebook is mainly for dinosaurs at this point. but it's just, you know, social media takes a lot of time if you're not careful. So, yeah.
I'm with you. I rarely use social media. I know I could be helping myself tremendously if I would invest in it more, but yeah. Facebook is still probably my number one, so I'm right there with you. Also, I have to apologize. I think I've been pronouncing your last name wrong the entire time we've been talking today.
That's okay.
I've been saying Evenson. Is it Evenson?
It's Evenson.
A friend of mine, his last name was Evenson, so I saw the same spelling. I apologize. No, Brian Evenson, everybody.
I think Evenson's the original pronunciation, but we got switched to Evenson when we came to the States, I think. So
gotcha. Yeah. Okay. I will never make that mistake again.
No worries. It didn't bother me. So
all right. Yeah, well, thank you again, Brian. I really do appreciate you coming on and talking
to me.
You're welcome. Thank you for bearing with me. I apologize to everyone I interview, because I'm still working on not bumbling my way through these.
I appreciate it. Thanks for having me on. It was a pleasure.
Absolutely. I'll talk to you soon.
Sounds good.